And also, just again to make this point, we have to stop and look at these things in a less linear way sometimes. I think what's really fascinating about these cases is that we're being asked time and time again to believe these incredible series of coincidences. We talked, of course, at length, and Dave just reviewed a lot of the information recently about the Hinckley family and their multitudinous connections to George Bush and the
Nazis and World Vision and CIA.
The CIA. We talked when we've done reports on death in Washington.
Worth remembering in that context, too, something I didn't even bother mentioning because I think most people are aware of it. But in spite of all the Nazi connections, the fact that these Nazi leaders said they thought Hinckley was a government agent, the connections to the Bush family, the World Vision connections and World Vision's apparent role as a CIA front in Central America and Latin America, the official version was that Hinckley shot Reagan so he could get it on with Jody Foster. Remember that.
Right. We talked about Michael Vernon Townley, the man known as the Jackal, not Carlos the Jackal, but Michael Vernon Townley the Jackal, who was implicated in the assassination of Orlando Letelier and Ronnie Moffitt in the streets of Washington, D.C. Townley comes from a long, long CIA family, and his people were, in fact, a CIA group expressly tied to the Pinochet government that overthrew Allende in Chile. Now,
George Bush being director of Central Intelligence at the time that particular killing occurred.
That's right. Now we've got a case where we have we're looking back on Arthur Bremer, and we have Arthur Bremer himself, the man who, with no source of income, follows George Wallace around and shoots Wallace, thereby causing a definitive change in the 1972 presidential election.
Causing a definitive change in the laws of criminal investigations, too, since apparently the paraffin tests were negative, which raises questions as to how he could possibly have fired a gun at all.
Now, Arthur Bremer, again, one of these odd coincidental kind of all-in-the-family sort of things. Arthur Bremer, on one hand, his sister Gail Aiken happens to go to work for people affiliated with Jerry Owen and the Robert F. Kennedy assassination. On the other hand, his brother William Bremer happens to get in trouble in Florida and just happens to be to wind up with a defense attorney who's also the defense attorney for the Watergate burglars. Now, again, those of you who know about, for instance, the Miami scene, or at least from what we've been able to see about it from our shows here, know how very tight the web is between the various drug dealers, the attorneys, the mafia, and all that down in Florida, and especially as regards national security-related or CIA-related items. Now, the chance that the Watergate burglars would have an attorney who was not a CIA-related or a CIA-connected attorney seems to me so slim as to be laughable. And the fact that Ellis Rubin, the same attorney, just happened to be Arthur Bremer's brother's attorney. Again, we got the entire Bremer family hooked up with the infrastructure and involved in various political chicanery of one sort or another.
And we see the religious right reflected both in the background of the Hinckleys as well as the Jerry Owen and Arthur Bremer. Arthur Bremer hooked up with Jesus freaks, Jerry Owen a right-wing evangelist, the Hinckley family involved with World Vision.
That's right. And just as we're expected to look at Lee Harvey Oswald's numerous connections to the intelligence system, establishment, and Jack Ruby's connections to the mob and the intelligence establishment, and we're supposed to look at this and assume that they were both lone nuts acting for their own reasons. We're being asked to believe the same thing about Bremer, about Sirhan, on down the line. It's not even a very good cover-up anymore, folks. I mean, it's really pretty obvious that that the fix was in on all of these things, and that the history of the United States in the last half of the 20th century has been written largely in blood and bullets.
Anthony Olazowicz, another member of the White House Dirty Tricks team, just happened to have been the head of the Bureau of Special Services for the New York City Police Department, the quote anti-red unquote, or the quote anti-organized crime and anti-red squad of the New York City Police Department, and yet it turns out that all these people just happen to be connected with other people from the other assassinations. Jerry Owen hooked up, for example, with people connected to Edgar Eugene Bradley from the John Kennedy assassination, other interesting connections of that kind. Ed Butler showing up in the background of the John and Robert Kennedy assassinations, then saying of the Manson family killings, it's obviously the work of the Black Panthers and so on and so forth. One of the reasons, again, why it's important to understand these things is so when you see the very untimely and tragic death of a man like Willie Velasquez of galloping cancer, it at a time when he could have harnessed perhaps the Latino American vote on behalf of Michael Dukakis, and in order to make up for the perceived hole left in the Dukakis Southern strategy by the death of Willie Velasquez, we see Lloyd Benson, one of the four senatorial Democrats in favor of Contra Aid, a fellow supportive of, among others, Jonas Savimbi, a classic old-line Texas conservative Democrat, running behind Michael Dukakis just as another O-line Texas conservative Democrat Lyndon Baines Johnson ran behind John Fitzgerald Kennedy from Massachusetts in order to balance Kennedy's perceived deficiencies among reactionary voters in the South. And as we took a look at not too long ago, Robert Kennedy, apparently, according to Robert Kennedy, John Kennedy was going to dump Lyndon Johnson, which was one of a number of key mistakes that John Kennedy made and which he came to regret, but not for very long.
With those pleasant thoughts bubbling in your mind, we are going to take a break, and when we come back, we will be answering your telephone calls.
An excellent and, I think, very important piece of research has been done by a fellow named Jim, one of our listeners and a former phone screener up here at One Step Beyond, namely the death by cancer, by fast-acting cancer, of a key Latino political leader named Willie Velasquez. Velasquez, as we're going to see, was just about to go to work for Michael Dukakis' campaign. He was a key Latin electoral leader, that is to say, a key person with regard to Latino voter registration in the West and Southwest, and, as I said, was about to go to work for Michael Dukakis' campaign. Unfortunately, he was cut down by fast-acting cancer. Reading from the Los Angeles Times of Thursday, June 16th of 1988, courtesy of this listener, this is by Bert A. Folkert, F-O-L-K-A-R-T, of the L.A. Times. This is headlined, Willie Velasquez, Leader of Latino Political Movement. Willie Velasquez, a butcher's son who significantly lengthened the stride of the Latino political power movement, died in San Antonio on Wednesday. The founder of the Southwest Voter Registration Education Project, the nation's largest Latino-oriented voter registration program, was 44 and had been battling cancer. A veteran of Cesar Chavez's campaign in the 1960s to organize farm workers in the Rio Grande Valley, Velasquez moved from the fields of the Southwest to its polling places, A veteran of Cesar Chavez's campaign in the 1960s to organize farm workers in the Rio Grande Valley, Velasquez moved from the fields of the Southwest to its polling places when he founded the Southwest Voter Registration Education Project in 1974. Although Velasquez would go on to lecture at Harvard University and become a devotee of the works of British prime ministers, he remained proudest of persuading his fellow Latinos to take political power into their own hands. He accomplished this, he liked to say, by talking the merits of pavement, unquote. When we got Mexican-American candidates saying, vote for me and I'll pave the streets, unquote, he told Newsweek in 1987, that's when the revolution started. For 14 years, he cajoled, lobbied, and prodded his fellow Mexican-Americans into entering the system by registering to vote and running for office. Under his guidance, the project launched about 1,000 voter registration drives in 200 cities and Indian reservations and conducted extensive polling, a spokesman said. What we're most proud of is that from 1974, when we started, to 1987, the number of Hispanic elected officials in the United States grew from 1,566 to 3,038, an increase of 82%, the spokesman added. That's quite an increase, I would add. Continuing with the article, Velasquez's group also was at the forefront of several court actions that banned the gerrymandering of political districts and at-large voting in cities and counties that prevented the election of minority candidates. Following the project's successes in Texas, New Mexico, and Colorado, Velasquez's organization was training its sights on California, where as of a year ago, Latinos held only 466 offices throughout the state. The project also launched a state voter registration drive that resulted in the registration of 6,000 Latinos in the East Los Angeles area alone. Most recently, said Bob Brichetto, B-R-I-S-C-H-E-T-T-O, executive director of the Southwest Voter Registration Institute, a branch of Velasquez's project, Velasquez was considering a staff advisory post with the Michael Dukakis presidential campaign. And in this next article gleaned for us by a listener, I think the significance of the Velasquez or the intended Velasquez participation in the Michael Dukakis campaign will become clear. Now, obviously, Willie Velasquez was a groundbreaker in terms of opening up on the American political process to Latino participation. The role that he might have played in the Dukakis campaign was very significant because the Dukakis campaign is worried about its chances in the West and in the South, and they're very concerned with attracting minorities, and in particular Latino minorities, in the Southwest in order to counter a lot of the conservative white vote in that area. Again, from the Los Angeles Times, this from the L.A. Times of June 17th of 1988 by David Lauter, L-A-U-T-E-R, of the L.A. Times. It's Dateline Nashville, Tennessee. Headline, Dukakis starting three-day swing in South says he can break GOP hold on region. Skipping down on the article, Nashville was the first stop on a three-day swing that will take Dukakis to Miami, where he will continue his recent emphasis on his record of fighting crime and drugs, and then on to Mississippi, Louisiana, Alabama, and Texas, where he will speak at the funeral of prominent Latino leader Willie Velazquez, and perhaps meet with his remaining rival for the Democratic nomination, the Reverend Jesse Jackson. Skipping down still further, while appealing to more conservative voters, Dukakis is taking steps as well to build support among blacks and Latinos, the two minority groups that have formed the party's most loyal base in the South and Southwest. Dukakis's two senior black advisors, longtime aide Joe Warren and Donna Brazile, and a former aide to top presidential hopeful Representative Richard A. Gephardt, Democrat of Missouri, who has now joined Dukakis as deputy national field director, are accompanying Dukakis on the trip. Skipping down. Saturday, Dukakis will speak in San Antonio, Texas, at the funeral of Velazquez, who was one of the nation's leading Latino political figures as head of the Southwest Voter Registration Project until his death Thursday of cancer at the age of 45. Velazquez had been slated to introduce Dukakis Saturday at the Texas State Democratic Convention and to join the campaign as a senior advisor. So, and it goes on to say, campaign aides know Dukakis must win heavily among those minority groups while gaining about 40% or more of the white voters to prevail in the South. Again, campaign aides know Dukakis must win heavily among those minority groups while gaining about 40% or more of the white votes to prevail in the South. So again, the strategic significance of the Velazquez participation in the Dukakis campaign, I think, is illustrated to a greater extent by that particular article. More about Willie Velazquez, and to give you an idea of just what kind of a leader he was, and also some ominous details concerning the nature of his death by cancer. This from the San Francisco Examiner of Wednesday, June 22nd of 1988. This is David Broder's column for that day, headlined or titled, Obit for Willie. Skipping down, as Willie talked about his charts, the columns of numbers came alive. His passion was the empowerment of people, his people, who have been the last of the major strains in our complex society to grasp and exercise the power of their numbers. The statistics say that in 14 years he ran SVREP, the number of Hispanic registered... The statistics say that in the 14 years he ran SVREP, the number of Hispanic registered voters doubled to 5 million, and so did the number of Spanish-surnamed elected officials. Willie's role was crucial. He did three jobs at least. He used his national contacts to raise the funds for the organization. He directed its ambitious research program, insisting that it be scrupulously objective, and, as he once told me, not kid anybody about how far we have to go, especially not kid ourselves, unquote. But his most important mission, the one he really enjoyed, was organizing the local registration, voting, and redistricting drives. Hard as it was to overcome the inertia and the fear he found in the barrios, he always came back stimulated by the challenge and the hope. The last time I saw him, one late afternoon last year, he was back in San Antonio after an organizing trip somewhere in the valley. And he asked me to join him in a debriefing session with his staff members before we did anything else. He was dog-tired, but he had a dozen follow-up assignments for them. Then we talked politics, from the 1988 presidential prospects to the situation of his friend and mayor, Henry Cisneros, of whom he spoke with a wonderful mixture of pride, affection, and critical detachment. He suggested we go on to dinner, but I had another appointment, something I wish I now had canceled. Interrupting here, remember the association of Velazquez and Mayor Henry Cisneros. The cancer that killed Willie Velazquez was diagnosed only in the third week of May. Bear in mind, he died on June 25th. The cancer that killed Willie Velazquez was diagnosed only in the third week of May. He was told he had 6 months to a year to live, and he called Michael Dukakis, a man he had met while on a brief sabbatical at the Institute of Politics of Harvard's John F. Kennedy School of Government. He told Dukakis that with whatever time was left, he wanted to go ahead with the plan they'd been discussing for Willie to become the prospective Democratic nominee's deputy campaign manager. 3 weeks later, Dukakis delivered a eulogy at Willie's funeral mass. And again, the deputy campaign manager position would have been perhaps very, very significant for Dukakis's long-term Southern strategy, in as much as it was going to depend very heavily on the participation of Latino, on the successful participation of Latino voters, obviously something Velazquez was in a position to have a very significant effect on. Now, this obviously is against the background of a number of things. We have documented in the past that our national security establishment, which has not hesitated to assassinate American political officials in the past, as we've looked at considerable length, they have had since at least 1954 the means of giving people cancer. In particular, they can produce a very rapidly acting cancer, and this is obviously to be noted against the background of Willy Velasquez's untimely death. Whether it was a natural cancer or one brought about artificially remains to be seen. It's significant, too, I think, that he was close to Mayor Henry Cisneros of San Antonio. Recently, a member of one of these ultra-right-wing tax protest groups, one of these Posse Comitatus spinoffs, was arrested for plotting against the life of Henry Cisneros right about the same time as a couple of reputed members, they've denied it, but reputed members of the Covenant of the Ark, the Sword, and the Word of the Lord had been arrested for threatening Jesse Jackson. It was my interpretation at the time that they were sending a message to Jesse Jackson rather than actually trying to kill him, which they certainly could have done, and as much as they've done it to a lot of other people in the past. I wonder whether the threat against the life of Henry Cisneros may have been connected with the death of Willy Velasquez as well. Certainly, I think it's worth thinking about whether or not Cisneros was being sent a message that perhaps if he didn't fall in line, he might wind up the way some other people have. Again, one talks about timing. The death of Willy Velasquez and the sudden onset of Mays cancer, which appeared to come on very quickly, and the dismissal of the Christic Institute suit all happened within a few days. I remember reflecting on the death of Willy Velasquez and reflecting on it against the background of May's illness. And by the way, May was operated on, for those of you who haven't heard, for cancer of the uterus. The prospects at this point are excellent for her eventual recovery. The situation is looking quite good. She's far too weak to take any phone calls or letters at this time. People should wait 3 or 4 weeks. Again, that's something people should just hold off on. But I remember hearing about May's surgery the morning that I was reading about the Christic Institute suit having been tossed out and thinking, well, gee whiz, you know, I remember reading Singlaub's attorney's statement that now it's payback time, unquote, and I was thinking, yeah, honest, huh? Man's telling the truth. As I mentioned last week, I had been given some incorrect information concerning May's medical condition and as a result thought it was worse than it actually was. It's still obviously a very serious and shocking development to all people concerned, but the prognosis is excellent at this point. I had thought that the situation was, in fact, of tragic dimensions due to the misinformation that had resulted from this misunderstanding. At any rate, the situation is better, but I'll tell you, hearing about Velasquez and then hearing about May and reading about the Christic Institute suit, plus the terrible pressures that have been brought to bear on Dave, our Italian translator, the psychological warfare, what appears to have been a very serious attempt on his life by a hit-and-run driver, a would-be hit-and-run driver who attempted to run him down in a pickup truck. The last few weeks have been really quite something, a lot of good news. At any rate, the prospects for May Brussels' recovery are excellent. It is a shame that the same was not the case for Willy Velasquez, and one wonders if perhaps Willy Velasquez's sudden demise may have been part of Election 88. Remember now that George Bush, who we have speculated about as head of the CIA when the Edwin Wilson group penetrated most of the world's terrorist organizations, that basically much of the upsurge in world terrorism that we've been seeing may be intended to create a right-wing militaristic sentiment in this country, which would benefit George Bush at the polls this coming year. At any rate, all of these things, food for thought, grounds for further research. That concludes the prepared portion of the broadcast.
This is Dave Emery thanking all the listeners for their contributions and encouraging them to tune in next week and keep up the good work. Thanks for listening. Good evening.